Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter Tim Weiner, who won the Pulitzer Prize for his work on secret intelligence and national security. He has covered the Central Intelligence Agency in Washington and terrorism in Afghanistan, Pakistan, the Sudan, and other nations. And he's the author of Legacy of Ashes, Betrayal, and his latest book just out is Enemies, A History of the FBI. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tim Weiner.
Thanks, Ian.
And this book is, most Americans think of the FBI as America's police force, but your book shows that it's really first and foremost an intelligence agency.
That's right, and it always has been, at least for most of the past 100 years, since it was first founded by President Teddy Roosevelt back in 1908. Yeah, secret intelligence operations against the enemies of the state, hence the title, enemies, anarchists, communists, leftists, your listeners.
You bet. Each and every one of them.
That's right. You were on the enemies list, or you might have been at one time.
Well, also, though, your book, Tim Weiner, Enemies, A History of the FBI, points out that because I think a couple of National Security Agency analysts defected to the Soviet Union and it was revealed or assumed that they were homosexual, that Eisenhower ordered Hoover to do a kind of purge, and Hoover sort of equated homosexuality with communism. And
true. Hoover, and he was not alone in this, going back to the 1930s, conflated homosexuality and communism. Why? We're leading up, of course, up to the $64,000 question about Hoover's own sexuality, and we'll get to that in a minute. Hoover conflated communism and homosexuality because they both had secret languages, secret codes, they met in secret places, they had secrets. This was reinforced in the 40s and 50s when, and you'll know this, Ian, Kim Philby and his aide de camp, who were working for the KGB and British intelligence, Guy Burgess and Donald McLean, were flushed out. And of course, this went back to Cambridge and Oxford in the 30s, and there was, in fact, a nexus, wasn't there, between communism and homosexuality. This was reinforced when Hoover recruited his great informant and defector, Whitaker Chambers, who's the man who fingered Alger Hiss as a communist. Chambers was an editor and writer at Time magazine, and he had been in the 30s both a secret communist in the Communist Party underground, working for Soviet espionage, and a secret homosexual. So,
along with Roy Cohn, right?
Well, Roy Cohn is a different story.
I see.
That's a very different story.
Well, he sort of overlaps with McCarthy, though, doesn't he?
He worked for Joe McCarthy.
Right.
So this leads us up to the great question of, was Hoover, who persecuted gays in the government going back to 1937 and for the next 35 years until his death, rooted out gays in the government, persecuted them, hounded them, ruined their lives. Did he do this because he was a repressed homosexual, a closet case, and working out his rage on the American people? The answer is no.
So you should have told Clint Eastwood that, Tim Weiner.
It makes a great story. Unfortunately, it's not true. The entire thing is like an inverted pyramid that rests on one point. The assertion by a British journalist that Hoover liked to wear tutus, had an active but secret homosexual life, that entire assertion rests on the testimony of one convicted perjurer, and it collapses like a house of cards when you touch it.
That's Anthony Summers, right?
Yeah.
That was the Anthony Summers book, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, so just briefly, though, who was the perjurer?
She was the fourth wife of a bootlegger who became a legitimate alcohol distributor.
All right.
Named Rosenfield. Right. His company was Shenley Industries.
Right.
And she was an unfortunate woman, and she was actually convicted of perjury before she told this remarkable story to the aforementioned British journalist.
So what about the fact that he and Clyde Tolson lived together? Was that sort of...
They were, in fact, inseparable friends.
Right.
Clyde Tolson was, of course, Hoover's number two at the FBI. They went on vacation together in San Diego at the La Jolla Resort. They played the ponies together, and Tolson was his loyal number two. And anybody who's seen the movie has got vivid memories of the two men kissing, wrestling, and then fighting.
Right.
It's a myth. It's a convenient myth. And it was used by Hoover's enemies in the government, on the right and on the left, to try and destroy him. It does not have the virtue of being true.
Well, I suppose, you know, in love and war, what is true? Nothing is true in Washington, right? Truth is a moving...
Ian, I have made an entire lifetime trying to winkle out the truth from secrets. So
sure.
I assert that there is...
Of course there is. I'm being sarcastic in as much as we live in a... It's true. The people you've been after, the people who hold the secrets, that's been your main beat.
And I try to document my work, and as you know, I put hundreds and thousands of endnotes in my books so that every quote and every assertion is documented and on the record.
Again, I'm speaking with Tim Weiner, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his work on secret intelligence and national security. His latest book just out is Enemies, A History of the FBI. And there's a couple of things that there's a great scene in your book, by the way, which filled in a big chunk of the story that I've always been fascinated with, because I recall that during the Bush era, when there was the so-called NSA wiretaps operating, there was an amazing scene where the head of the FBI and the acting attorney general, Comey, went to the Ashcroft's bedside. And in your book, I didn't realize that Ashcroft's wife had actually got a phone call from the president asking her to hand the phone over and saying it was a matter of national security, and she had refused to do so.
It's a Shakespearean scene.
It's extraordinary, yeah.
Where the attorney general is close to death, and he turns down the request from, you know, Bush's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern to authorize an illegal program, which was the president's program of electronic eavesdropping. But the even more amazing scene happens the next day, after this extraordinary confrontation, where Ashcroft, you know, like the ghost of Christmas past, raises his head from the bed and says, "There's the Attorney General," pointing to the acting Attorney General, James Comey, who would not go along with the Bush wiretapping program. And Robert Mueller, the head of the FBI today, who has served longer in that post than anyone but Hoover, confronted Bush in the White House the next day. Robert Mueller, FBI director, to his great credit, had written his resignation letter by hand at 1:30 in the morning, put it in his breast pocket, and walked into the Oval Office, and the head of the FBI said to the President of the United States, "Mr. President, your electronic eavesdropping program is illegal and unconstitutional. Unless you skin it back, I will resign, the Attorney General will resign, and his six underlings will resign." And Bush said, "What?" And he thought, and we have this from his own memoir, George W. Bush, he thought back to Nixon's Saturday Night Massacre, which had happened 40 years before, where Nixon went through two attorneys general and the command structure of the entire Justice Department, who resigned rather than support the obstruction of justice. And Mueller won. Bush did skin it back, the electronic eavesdropping program, but in the process, he lied to the FBI. The President of the United States lied to the Director of the FBI, and that is a felony, punishable by 5 years in prison. It was a very close thing.
So what does this say, though, Tim Weiner, in the broader question of what is the FBI and what is their role?
Exactly.
Most people, particularly our listeners here, see them as the ones that spy on Quakers and anti-war activists.
Of course they do. And that is part of their history. But
I was going to just let me just finish the thought here that there's also this other side that story tells us. And there's also the case of Mark Felt, who turned out to be the deep throat, that was clearly felt that things had gone awry in terms of the top of the power structure, and felt that through leaking it to the Washington Post, he had to, that was his sort of patriotic duty. Am I correct in saying there are two sides of this?
You are correct. Let it not be forgotten that Mark Felt, who was the number two man and in effect the acting director of the FBI after Hoover died, was Deep Throat. He was the man, along with at least four of his senior FBI colleagues, who brought down Richard Nixon. It wasn't Woodward and Bernstein. Everything they got right came directly from the FBI, and it was the FBI's evidence that sent Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mitchell, and Dean to prison and drove Richard Nixon from the White House. It was also the FBI that stood up to George W. Bush and his electronic eavesdropping program, which was equally illegal, as illegal as the burglary of the Democratic headquarters. The rights of the people of the United States to be secure in their homes against illegal searches and seizures has both been violated by the FBI and upheld by the FBI.
So they're both the arsonist and the fire brigade.
That is right. And why is that? Because going back to the founding of the United States, we have had a struggle between liberty and security, between freedom and danger. We need to be both safe and free. Liberty and security are both necessary for a free republic, but they are opposing forces. You cannot have one without the other, and we need both, but they are at war with one another. And ever since the Americans overthrew the British king, we have had this struggle in this country between liberty and security. It is a tug of war, and the FBI is at the center of this struggle, and they have to calibrate this calculus every day, because on the one side, on the security side, you know, are the military and, you know, the conservatives and the people who live in fear, who say, if you don't do this, and this being, you know, spy on people, break into their homes, steal their secrets, people will die. And on the other side are the forces of, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of the press, civil liberties, who say, if you do that, we will lose our freedoms. And to his great credit, the present director of the FBI, and this may enrage some of your listeners, but here it is, has said that if we fight the war on terror but lose our freedoms, we will lose.
So let's go to Louis Free, though, because I wanted to get to that, because I've always thought the story of John O'Neill was an extraordinary story and a deeply ironic one, given that he quit in frustration, I think frustration, right, with Louis Free, and became the head of security for the World Trade Center and died on 9/11. I've also spoken to at length with Ali Soufron, who was in many ways
a real hero.
Really, a real hero and a protege, I think, of to some extent, of John O'Neill's.
Ali Soufron is sui generis. For your readers, this is a man who worked for the FBI, who was a native Arabic speaker, graduate of Villanova, joined the FBI on a whim, and he's the man who brought down the CIA's secret torture program as an FBI agent, who blew the whistle on the CIA's secret prison and on waterboarding, an extraordinary feat. And he too quit the FBI in frustration in 2005.
So what was with Louis Free? Because I know, for example, he coddled that guy Hansen. I don't know whether it's because they were both Opus Dei or whatever it was. I think
here is the long story short on Louis Free, who was the head of the FBI throughout almost the entire Clinton presidency from September 93 onward.
And Clinton didn't speak to him, right?
Free didn't speak to Clinton.
Right.
And the reason is that from day one, the head of the FBI, Louis Free, regarded the president of the United States as the target of a criminal investigation. And being a purist and a sanctimonious man, he would not speak to the president. They spoke perhaps half a dozen times during Clinton's presidency, and not at all for a four-year stretch at the end of Clinton's presidency. This is a disaster. And it is one of the proximate causes of 9/11. When you have a head of the FBI who won't talk to the president, and the CIA and the FBI aren't talking to each other, this is a recipe for the downfall of intelligence. And you can say what you will, but about the need for intelligence and about intelligence services, but they are a fact of life, like the post office and the tax man. And they might as well be good at what they do. And to be good at what they do, they will protect and defend the Constitution of the United States without violating the rights of the people of the United States. Throughout most of history, the FBI has not been good at this. And I would argue in the last 3 years they're trying much harder to get it right.
So is this a case then, given the enormous influence and imprint, if you will, that J. Edgar Hoover had over the FBI, and then we talked about Louis Freeh's massive deficiencies, and you're, I think, without putting words in your mouth, suggesting that the current incumbent, Mueller, has been restored some of the constitutional character or what...
He's tried to put, and this is a very difficult and I think uniquely American dilemma, he's tried to put secret intelligence operations on a constitutional footing. To do intelligence under law. And that is no mean feat.
But what does it say, though, about an organization? Is it that dependent, and is it that easily shaped by the people at the top? Because I talked to a bunch of FBI people over the years, and they said one of the first things that Louis Freeh did was to tell everybody to get rid of their computer and go back to their notebooks. I mean, good Lord, if that's true, we're lucky to have survived him.
The FBI still has, as a consequence of this, less computer capability than your average 14-year-old in the United States. But that's a different issue, really.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to get back to first principles here, which is if you're going to live in a nation that has been and for the foreseeable future will be a superpower and projects its power beyond its borders, you're going to have an intelligence service. I mean, this has been true since Joshua took Jericho. A nation that projects power has spies, and therefore counter-spies, spying against the people who are spying against it. You can't abolish them any more than you can abolish the post office or abolish the IRS. They exist because this is a modern society. So you want them, since you must have them, to operate on a legal basis and to protect and defend the Constitution, as they're sworn to do, and to strike a balance between security and liberty, and to help us be both safe and free. Throughout most of its history, the FBI, because of the great power of J. Edgar Hoover and because of the long shadow he has cast in the 40 years since his death, has not gotten that right and has not operated on a constitutional basis. And to the extent that it does today, in part because we have a fan of the Constitution in the Oval Office and because we have a pretty loyal public servant running the FBI who does what the president tells him to do, they are starting to try and get it right. And as much as we fault them for their past behavior, I think we need to recognize that they are trying to do that. This may be a very brief epoch in the annals of the United States of America, but it is happening, and it gives one hope.
Well, Tim Weiner, I thank you for joining us here today.
It is always a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Tim Weiner, as a Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his work on secret intelligence and national security. He's covered the Central Intelligence Agency in Washington and terrorism in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Sudan and other nations, and is the author of Legacy of Ashes, Betrayal, and his latest book just out, Enemies, A History of the FBI. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about a way to overturn Citizens United.
I don't figure I'll be back there for a spell. Even though Rita moved away and got a job at our motel, he still waits for me, constant on the sly. He wants to turn me into the FBI. Me, I romp and stomp, thankful as I romp. Without freedom of speech, I might be in the swamp.